Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Good afternoon. I want to welcome you to today's broadcast of the American College Experience. My name is Jason Haynes. I'm the host of this show and also the Chief Executive Officer of the UR Tennis Network. I want to say congratulations if you're listening for the first time today. I believe that you have found one of the best-kept secrets in tennis, which is our network. We have been on the air for over 4 years now. We have over 1,600 hours of libraried interviews, and we continue to grow each and every week, so we're excited that you've joined us. Just ask that you would tell a friend or someone, another tennis player, about us, because we don't do a lot of advertising. We rely on word of mouth to get our message across. On today's program, we have Coach Chuck Creasy. Chuck is a good friend of the network. He's even a host of his own radio show. And we're excited that he's going to be coming in today. We're going to offer you a little different experience with Chuck. Normally what we do is we talk a little politics with Chuck in regards to college tennis. And today we're going to give you a visit to the Citadel and let you know what he's doing there, why he's there, and what's going on there. Not to mention politics. It would be couth of me to bring Chuck on the show and not let him talk a little bit about the politics of tennis, so we'll get to that towards the end of the interview, and we'll bring him on here shortly. There's lots of big college news going on with lots of dual matches started to be played, hidden duels as they're called, across the U.S. of A. Lots of teams, ranked, unranked, that are participating in these matches so that they can get their players on-court time in both singles and doubles, to get them ready for the dual match season, which is quickly approaching. I know a lot of my JC friends have to wait until around February 1st to get their program dual match schedule underway, and they are licking their bits to get going. So I know that the Division I's are able to start a little bit earlier. Division II's, they cannot participate for another couple of weeks as their schedule of on-court time and dual match time is limited, along with the Division III's. And I know that some people out there are kind of glad that that's not happening, particularly those coaches that do not have indoor courts. As the outdoor winter can be brutal on a coach standing there and watching a tennis match versus a player that is playing a tennis match. And I, for one, am grateful that that's a part of the college coaching mess that I do not have to put up with. I can remember several times being out on the court in under 30-degree weather at a JC dual match and just hoping for survival amongst my players. The tennis balls become like rocks, and it's not much fun to sit out in a college tennis match when the weather is under 30 degrees, the wind's blowing at about 20 miles an hour, and you're trying to coach your players to grow on a cold day. We did a lot of good on cold days, don't get me wrong. It was just one of those times that you don't miss in regards to college tennis, along with all the paperwork that goes in there. So we've got a lot to talk about today, so I'm going to bring Coach Creasy in the air here, and we'll get going. Coach Creasy, are you there?
Yeah. Hi, Jason. How are you?
I'm having a good day today. We got kind of sunny weather here in Tyler, Texas, and it's warm, so I don't have anything to complain about.
That's good. It's on and off. Say hi out there to the great Coach John Peterson, if you can. Wow, what a great man out there. You know, so thank you for having me on.
Yeah, you bet. Now, today we're going to do it a little bit different. We're going to talk about the Citadel first here, Coach, because on air, you and I really haven't discussed much about what's going on there. So we're going to give people kind of a virtual recruiting tour here and let them know. And then we're going to get into the discussion about the college tennis format changes, about some of the NCAA ongoing things that are happening, and just get your opinion about some of these things. But first and foremost, and we don't have to do any biographical information on you because you have given it over and over again, but you are at the Citadel. Why don't you let people know where the Citadel is at, Coach?
Well, the Citadel is 172 years old. It was started in 1842, and it's in Charleston, South Carolina. And actually, this will tell you something. They've got a T-shirt around here that says, the Citadel, we've only started one war yet. And they started the cadets started the civil, and that's a funny thing. The cadets actually, and they were the ones that fired on Fort Sumter, if you can believe that. And they only, you know, of course, the story is only a mule was killed, but unfortunately, in the Civil War, we lost so many people more than ever. But the military heritage, there are six military colleges in the United States, the Citadel and VMI are a little bit unique in that they have similar pathways. You don't have to go into the military afterwards like you do at Army, Navy, Air Force, and Coast Guard. You can go through the Citadel, and about 50%, actually 48% of our cadets, and male and female cadets, about 2,000 males, about 200 females, but about 48% take a commission upon graduation into Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and Coast Guard, and then about 52% leave with a great degree, and everyone gets a minor in leadership training, which is an outstanding thing. And we brag that this is the fourth year in a row that Citadel is the number one, voted the number one public institution in all of the South. The academics are extremely good, and the training is extremely good, and they boast 100% hiring rate if you go through the Citadel and you do everything in it. So that's a little bit about the history, and I'm extremely proud to be here at this stage in my life and my career, as after 50, there used to be a book out called Halftime, and I remember, and it's so true, that after 50, you start searching for significance more than you do success. You want to do something that is impacting on other people's lives or something that is that just can make a difference. And, you know, that's what I feel Jason can hear. I was done with coaching. I mean, I was done with college coaching, and I could give you those reasons if you want. But the number one reason, my AD asked me when I left Clemson after 33 years, he says, well, what's the main reason you're planning to hang it up at the end of this year? And I said, well, I've lost the belief. Well, I first said I want to be able to grow old gracefully. Secondly, I said I've lost the belief in what college athletics really stand for. And he is retired now, so I could say that I could quote him and say, well, I don't really disagree with you. With that one, I said we have too much political correctness and too many agendas instead of the educational value that it was set up for. So the Citadel is in the beautiful number one city in America and top 10 in the world, voted Charleston, South Carolina. It's stunningly beautiful and wonderful place to live. And
Coach, how big is Charleston?
Oh, gosh. You know, the whole state of South Carolina now is 4.8 million. And to give you an idea, Atlanta has almost 6 million people. So the whole state of South Carolina is not highly as populated as the city of Atlanta. But I would guess there are probably 400,000 people in Charleston. But it's booming, Jason, because of the Boeing industry. We have a right-to-work state. You know, the unions aren't here. And our great, great governor, Nikki Haley, fought hard and is fighting hard, and the one I'm trying to think the governor before her But they got Boeing to come in here, and by golly, the economy is booming down here. And just they're just taking off all the spin-off businesses and everything. It's a great, great place to live right now.
And Coach, it's got to be a beautiful campus. I mean, when you come on the Citadel and you come for a visit, it's got to be storied in rich tradition. Now, you are responsible for recruiting 4.5 athletes for scholarships there. And I'm curious, when you bring a recruit on campus, what are some of the degrees that you highlight for those kids that they might want to pursue while they're there at the Citadel?
Jason, that's a great question, because that's the first question I asked myself when I first came. My negotiating points, if not really wasn't money, it was things I asked the AD, can I have my family here a lot, my kids? And he said, well, it's a big family thing. I've got my kids coming over to ball games. They come over. They're on campus all the time. They're around the cadets. My son has great role models every day. You watch the parade on Fridays. It's just, it's stuff that really sends goosebumps up and down your spine. It's wonderful. I asked him that. And the second thing I asked him, Jason, was, can I have as many players on the team as I want? And he said, yeah, but why do you want that? I said, because I know what it takes to win. I knew what it took to win at Clemson. And they, the real one of the things that ran me out at Clemson was the fact that they started putting limits on how many players I could have. I worked the fool out of kids for the first 4 months and got as many to quit as I could, but I had as many as 25 kids. I didn't cut anybody for the first 18 to 20 years, and they had to go through tough training, and I couldn't care less if they could hit a ball or not, but I had my orange team, white team, and work team, and my after my top 10 or 12 players, I basically had a training corps of players, and the way I registered, see, Clemson is 100 miles from any town of any size, so there wasn't any tennis players to speak of within 100 miles of Clemson. So I always had my training base, and I'd train one player. You train them, you coach them up, as they say, and then I would recruit one, and so I only had to really go out and beat the bushes and try to beat another great team, you know, beat the Georgias or the Floridas or whoever for a player one a year, and then I could bring one off of my work team, my white team. They would get better. Well, they cut that, Jason. They made it to where, because of Title IX stuff, proportionality, because the women didn't have more than 10, I couldn't have more than 10. And twice I had to cut the number one ranked player in the state of South Carolina, who was a walk-on, if you could believe that, Jason.
Wow.
So that was a big point of contention. My last 3 years, I had had a lot of – I even talked to the Title IX guy when he came in. He was a good man. He was on my American Tennis – your network's American Tennis program. And I brought him on, but I used to say the argument is – the semantics on this, it's opportunities to compete versus bodies in the seat. You're telling me I can only have 10 players – and because women only have 10, well, why not give them 15 or 20 opportunities and let them have 15 or 20 players if they want? And if they can't get them to walk on, I could add 30 players all the time. Men want to play. And I don't want to get into that discussion, but basically I've always believed men need sports, women want sports, and some need. But for the most part, I could add 20 walk-ons. And I used to really, really get a lot of work done with that. So when I came to the Citadel, that was a point. And I don't have to cut, but I work the players hard, and they have a good routine, and they don't stay. We're down to 11 players right now. I started with 20. But I'm hoping to have 16 to 18 to 20 excellent players competing very, very hard for the top spot. So, Jason, recruiting is in many ways easier than it was at Clemson. And you might ask why. Well, why is it? It's so unique. And I think that polling at Army or Chris Garner at Navy or the great coach out at Coach Oster. Dang it, I'm trying to lost my trend of thought there about at Air Force, and we're going out there in a couple of weeks. But those guys would tell you that you really, it narrows the field. And when I'm bringing two recruits in tomorrow, actually, you know, I can't give names or anything like that, but I'm bringing two recruits in tomorrow, Jason, and, you know, when they come, I'll put them in the barracks. I'll put them through the cadet life for 48 hours or 36 hours, and they either come out of the recruiting visit, Jason, with their eyes wide open, go, whoa, no, I don't think so, coach, or they have this, I think I can do this. And when they get, I think I can do this, we got a great shot at really good players. And we had a very good recruiting year last year, 5-star, 4-star, and a couple 3. And then this year we have a fantastic recruiting year, got some very, very good players, and we're not done yet. But the last point on that, and I know this is long, but I want to set the table. As you know, our top 50 kids in the country get snatched up by everybody and anybody, but after that, 60 on down have to compete with 60 other countries of the world, and most people are trying to hunt for those ITF guys and things of foreign kids, and I'm saying, oh boy, I got this number 83 in the country, and this guy is an athlete. He played high school basketball, and this kid can go to the moon, and that's what I'm going after. And so the Citadel, we got a good shot here. Great place, great history. The training is great. I've got a great schedule going, and the only thing we don't have is maybe quite as much money as some of those big, big schools, and that has its benefits as well, because we're not even going to be in that daggone thing game where, we don't have the restrictions because of the money as well.
Yes, sir. Now, when you come on the campus there, of course, I'm curious about your facilities, Coach. How many courts do you have on campus?
We have 10, and we have a beautiful tennis center where it was by a couple private owners in honor of former coach and player that were here. And the history is very, very good. The heritage is good. It's been, they had a great coach, Don Bunch, was here for many, many years, and he was a great man and a great leader. And I was in awe of what he did back. In those days, they had clay courts here. We used to come in my early years to down here from Clemson, and I always said, "Wow, that would be a pretty cool place to work." You know, they have automatic compliance here. You don't have the self-sabotage. keg parties on Thursday nights, kids hung over on Saturday mornings, the partying. You don't have the guys self-sabotaging. They basically have everybody, they break them down and build them up, and it's a beautiful, beautiful thing to watch how these kids one guy, a sergeant major last week, was talking to one of my recruits. He said, here you advance only two ways, with time and with achievement. You don't advance any other way. They start everybody the same, and it doesn't matter where you came from or anything, but you only advance through achievement or with time, and it's a beautiful, beautiful thing, Jason.
Coach, do you have any indoor courts, or do you have to go off campus to use those, or what do you?
No. Well, you know, it never rains in Charleston. Come on, it's the number one city in America. No, we don't. There's no indoor courts really in this part, other than Hilton Head, a couple hours away. We have beautiful city Buford, where the Great Santini was filmed, and some of Forrest Gump and things, and Buford and Hilton Head. But, no, there's no indoor courts in all of Charleston. But we're pretty fortunate. It's sort of like it'll rain and dry sometimes. But since I've been here at 18 months, we missed 3 practices. So sometimes that's very welcomed by the cadets.
And, Coach, now you have completed your fall season. Let's talk a little bit about that. How many tournaments did you play?
We played 3 tournaments, and We had good outing up at Indiana University. We had our doubles team really made semifinals, beat the number one seeds up there and got to the semifinals, which was really good. That was good for one of our recruited freshmen and things. But I like to play these tournaments in the fall, Jason, where you get multiple matches. And as you know, one of the dumbed-down features in college tennis has been the reduction of match dates. You know, baseball gets 66, we get 25. And how they came up with that number is it was done in the early 90s, and I blame ITA. I blame, and I don't want to get into politics too soon, but I blame our leaders for not fighting like crazy like baseball did and preserving the opportunity or the number of opportunities that we used to get. And the proof's in the pudding. As you know, we only have three former USA-born players in the top 100 today, whereas in the mid-'80s and late-'80s, we had up to 39 or 40 of the top 100, and we're not developing the players. So I like to play multiple matches, as many matches as possible. In the fall, you get the reps, and then what happens is in the spring, you try to get your team together, and I'd like to have four or five multiple, you know, tournaments where you get four or five matches. I want my match count for each player to be from 40 to 50 a year, and unless you really, really work hard for that, it's a very, very hard thing to do to get 40 or 50 reps. And
right.
So,
now, did you play an ITA regional, coach?
No, I didn't. You know, and don't mind saying this, I'm not joining ITA, and I'm hoping I never join the daggone thing again. Everybody out there needs to know the ITA is a coaches organization. You have to pay $500 to get a scorebook. The representation is basically a dictatorial situation where mandates are passed down by this coaches organization. They do not have the authority, Jason, to mandate what they do. They've gained influence, great influence over the years, and just because they have not been challenged and because they've set it up, the structure. It used to be the ITCA, the Intercollegiate Tennis Coaches Association. Now, to prove my point, if they were, they had any authority, we all work for our schools, we work for and we're members of the NCAA. Just as the NCAA has no power to tell the USTA what to do or the ITA what to do, the USTA does not have power, nor does the ITA have power to tell the NCAA what to do. Now, most people do not know this fact. They must convince the cabinet, the NCAA cabinet, to move forward with their directives. Now, the only reason the cabinet listens to ITA is there's never been another game in town. And they have sort of influenced that situation. That situation, they've influenced it. And please forgive me, I'm driving a little bit here. I got to be careful, and I won't wreck. But they've influenced that situation over the years. So it is a very much an implied power that they have. And for them to say that they are the ruling body or the governing body of college tennis is as bad as the USTA. Think about this. Is the USTA the governing body of tennis, Jason?
Okay. No.
Now, why does everybody have to pay money to be members then? So you're saying, okay, everybody's got to pay a tax? Is that what we're paying, a tax to the governing agency of USTA? We got to pay $500 a year to ITA, the almighty ITA, to pay their big salaries? You know, it's really, really wrong at its fundamental base. And I was talking to a younger coach earlier, and they were asking, well, you know, isn't there these guys there's repercussions. They try to basically, they use coercive leadership, Jason. You're supposed to use leadership by, you know, by respect and by direction, or persuasive leadership, but their coercive leadership is is so wrong. It's just really, really upsetting. And they don't own college tennis. They don't own a lot of the D2s and junior college. There's many, many coaches that don't belong to the ITA, and I do not belong to the ITA. And being I never, ever belong to them, if I have to belong to them when we get in the top 20 just to get their little ranking deal, well, I'll have a good argument if we have a team good enough to get an NCAA and they keep us out because the ITA says so. So anyhow, it's a very, very frustrating thing for me and many, many coaches. And this latest thing that they're pushing through is horrid. It's very, very upsetting, and it's very much a show of disrespect to anybody in this country that loves tennis to dumb down things the way that they're going. So how do we get off on that, Jason?
It's all right. We're going to get to more of that as we go along through this. I'm curious, as you moved out of the fall season and into the spring, did you bring your kids in early this time, or are you one of those coaches that waits right up until school gets started to get those kids?
No, I brought them in early. We went down to Florida and trained and played a good tournament. And you got to do that. And here's why. And all coaches know this, that no matter what kind of a program you set up for your team to do the work over Christmas, home and the most disciplined kids eat too much turkey and too much pumpkin pie and all those things, and they come back out of shape. And unless you get on the horse right away and get them in the mindset of playing and competing, you're going to have a slow start and pretty bad season. So, yeah, no, I think everybody brings them back a little bit early now. It's just there's not enough events where they keep them busy in Christmas time otherwise.
Yeah. Hey, Coach, have you started dual matches yet, or are you still doing the hidden duels?
Yeah, we're 1-3 right now. We got smacked pretty good by Auburn last week, a doubleheader that we played. Boy, what a good team they had. We had a couple close matches, but pretty much they smacked us right now. There's difference between it's a fine line when somebody just a little better than you. You don't roll over, but and just say, thank you, sir, may I have another, and take a spanking. But at the same time, you can't just check out and when you play those real good teams and say, let's just have fun today. You've got to really compete and get to the bottom of what you're trying to do. And our team made tremendous, tremendous growth this last weekend.
Yeah. Now, when you look at your schedule, Coach, as you travel through the spring, what are some of the highlights that you have on there, matches that you're looking forward to?
Oh, gosh. We're going out to Air Force, which is great. We're going to go up to Indiana, actually. We're going up to play Murray State and Butler up there. We're not playing Indiana. We get to play North Carolina, Minnesota, Georgia Tech. We're playing Wake Forest. We're playing the best team in the country right now, probably, is Georgia Gwinnett. Are you familiar with Georgia Gwinnett?
Sir, I am. I've had Coach Hodges on the show.
So probably they might have the best team in the country. I mean, in NAIA, the rules are a little bit different, and you've got some high-level folks there. So what I'm trying to do in scheduling, Jason, is I believe the association breeds assimilation. You got to schedule well, but you ideally you get a third of the time you're winning, going away, a third of the time somebody's beating up on you, a third of the time is your level. So it's a third above, a third below, a third even. And that's good scheduling, but those are pretty much the highlights. Our conference is the Southern Conference, and last year Elon won, and Furman has got a very good team, very good coach, coaching there with Kelly Jones, very good. A really good team, and I'm just really impressed with the coach here, is Samford, outside Birmingham. And then you've got, it's competitive. You've got Eric Hayes down at Mercer. You've got Oh, golly, Wofford is good. East Tennessee State's back in the league. You know, Virginia, VMI is in the conference, but they don't have – can you believe VMI is in the conference? You know, but they don't have a men's team. So I don't know what the deal is on that, but we that'd be a good rivalry.
Yes, sir.
Playing Air Force is going to be great. I'm trying to do an Armed Forces weekend every year at the Citadel. We had Army and Air Force here last year at the Citadel, so that was really a big weekend.
Yes, sir. Now, when you play in the Southern Conference, does the Southern Conference set up dates for you to where you can play each team, or are you allowed the freedom not to play each other?
No, we play everybody. We do a round robin, which is great. And UT Chattanooga, I forgot about UT Chattanooga, and Carlos Garcia up there is a very experienced coach, a lot of years at Tennessee and there. We had the conference tournament then up there last year. We do a complete round robin, and then we will play a conference tournament at the end. Just it's pretty traditional in that. And I know what you're saying, though. A lot of teams, you know, the conferences are so spread out now that a lot are not requiring a round robin, which I think that's bad. I think that you ought to have to play teams in your conference.
I can't figure out, Coach, why you'd be in a conference if you're not playing your conference foes.
Well, you know, tennis, again, the funding, you can do a lot with a little bit of money if you do it smart, but once you start having to jump on planes a lot, then it just rules a lot of opportunities out. You know, people look at tennis all wrong when you talk about how much in trouble it is, Jason. They look at, hey, we don't have big crowds, but if you think about it, the type of youngsters that come and play tennis in college end up being your doctors, your lawyers, your businessmen who really do a lot for the school after graduation, you know. So it's really an interesting thing that for the educational value of it, we need to pass on those positive things about how good it is, you know. And I'm just ashamed that we have created, we're making tennis into an after school activity by dumbing it down instead of the great sport that it is. That's what we're doing when we dumb it down and try to make it entertainment the big reason that it's education over the entertainment, you know. So it's very frustrating.
And Coach, you play there in the Southern Conference. At the end of the season, you guys have a conference tournament you mentioned. Does that qualify you automatically for the NCAA Big Dance?
Yeah, if you win your conference, you get in the NCAAs. So last year, Elon won. They made the NCAAs. Elon won. They beat Duke last year. During the 6 weeks of mandated, forced NOAAD scoring, Bullwinkle scoring, we call it, and everybody out there should call it Bullwinkle 2, because this scoring system allows parity. Let's see why it's done. Okay, there is some agenda by USTA. They're behind this. They have to be, and then they give money to ITA, so ITA sort of buckles and does what they have to do to, you know, but USTA is behind it. And then, but this scoring system makes immediate parity, and it basically allows that parity to be without forehands and backhands and conditioning and toughness and all those things being important, as important. So you have teams that have good ball strikers and good talented kids that maybe haven't trained, and they surface as some of our best players, and our best players like Mitchell Frank, who went undefeated for 2 years, I think only lost one. I bet he would have taken 15 losses in NOAAD scoring. Steven Johnson is a good example. His father was on J.P. Weber's We Coach Tennis program. And he was, this was, I think, when he was back about 2-3 months ago, Jason, and he was undefeated. Steven Johnson was undefeated for 2 years, and his last 2 years. And I asked Mr. Johnson, I got on the phone or on the line, and I asked him, I said, if they were playing no ad scoring, do you believe that Steven would have taken a bunch of losses? He said, absolutely. I mean, he would have lost 10 to 15 matches. Would that have made a difference? You bet it would. So immediate parity by this no-ad scoring is the maybe one of the reasons some coaches want it. It brings parity. Well, whenever you champion the weak, you end up weakening the real champions. And it's a very, very bad thing. That in the worst is just the lack of respect for the game, that the lack of honor that the game should be shown. It's just awful. So, you know, the conference champions do get to go to the NCAA tournament. Elon last year in this Bullwinkle score, and then they beat Duke last year. If you can get that, and dang, they have a good team. Elon has a very, very good team, well-coached team, good team. But they, regular scoring, they don't beat Duke. You know, and we had so many teams take losses that shouldn't take. And you know what? In the end, the sad, sad thing is coaches lose their jobs over that.
That's so true, Coach. Now, as I am curious here, you're allowed at the NCAA Division I level 20 hours a week to practice with your kids. Can you take us through one day, Coach? I mean, if you start at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and you finish at 5, what does a kid do for you on the court and in the workout area there for you?
You know, usually years ago I used to write up every workout. I conducted over 10,000 practices at Clemson in my 33 years, I figured. And during that time that I did it, I used to write up every workout, and I would log everything and all that. But basically, it falls into a pattern of what you need and who needs it. There's times when we do completely team-related things that we need, whether it's the doubles or certain drills that we need to do just to get the base. So 60% of the stuff is team stuff that you have to have done that you got to do right. 40% of the time, you really just got to pay attention to what the heck is going on with each of the players. You know, what does this player need? Like, we have a very good player like today, or my assistant coach and I met. We have a very good player who is a counterpuncher, Jason, and he's excellent on scale 1 to 10. He's a 9 or a 10 on counterpunching, you know. But the point is his offense is not good enough. Now, any coach knows that you really need to work on your strength more than you do your weakness. Some people do that reverse, but I believe that you live and die with your strengths. You know, you've got to have strengths to go forward. But in his particular situation, his practice today is I'm putting him against 3 of the lower people on the team, and he's going to have to play all offensive things and try to get his offense going a little bit better. So what I'm trying to do is make the point that 60% we do individual or team-type things or drills. We work on tempo a lot. We work on overload stuff a lot. We work on ball strike. We work on lots of getting to deeper into the point-type things. But then with the individuals, I try to do competitions that get them to do the things that they can't do or the things that they're already good at to try to make the strength better. But in normal practice, I always bring the guys together at the start. I bring the guys together at the end. The start, we always start out with running. I do running every day before practice. I do it for 2 reasons. And I might run them between 4 and 14 sprints. And the reason I do it is, number one, to mentally get them engaged and get them to digest or finish, get rid of their day, whatever's gone. And you kids will come down and they're sort of loosey-goosey and, hey, what's going on? They're listening to little headphones and all this stuff. And I run them at first until I get the dead man's look in their eyes and where they're, whoa, okay, all right, I'm tired. Okay, All right, I'm ready to go. Okay. And when they get there, I don't start practice till I get them right like that. And then every day I work on footwork stuff for about 10 minutes. I overtrain the lower body, Jason, and upper body I let be more kinesthetic, but I overtrain the footwork and the movement and the recovery steps over and over and over where they can do it in their sleep. I do it every day. So the start of my practice takes about 20 minutes, and then I'll usually do a consistency type of thing that really gets their heads locked in. Then I'll bring them in, and then I'll do the team things I was telling you about, where I'll break them up into different types of two-on-ones, pinch drills, overload drills. I'll do that for about an hour, 45 minutes to an hour. Then every day toward the end, I will compete. I make it to where you have to, at Clemson I used to have where you would have to win to leave. And you have to win a set before you go home, or you've got to do a one-serve receiver comes in set, or you've got to win a conversion set. A conversion set is you win three in a row to win the game. You got to learn how to group points, or I would do these different types. If you miss wide, you go back to zero in the game. But I'll make guys have to win to leave. At the Citadel, every night at 6, they do reveille, and every kid stops in practice. They salute the flag. They listen to the bugler blow. And practice is done, and it's a beautiful thing, and you get a buzz when you leave, and then they got to be out of here at 6. So I can't keep them a long, long time. One last comment. At Clemson, it used to be cool before the days we were on a clock. I hate this 20-hour thing because it makes kids act like a doggone hourly employee, hour-paid employee that clocks in, clocks out. And you know what kind of work you get. I tell everybody you need to be like an executive that goes to work to get the job done. In the old days, we'd go and I'd say, boys, we got to get backhands better today. If backhands weren't better after 2.5-3 hours, Jason, I'd send the manager. I'd say, go get some pizzas, manager. We're going to be here for a while. And you'd get them right. Do you understand the beauty of that? We would work till the completion of the job instead of just the hourly lesson type mentality. So yeah, I know that's a lot, but thanks for letting me explain all that.
No, that's exactly what we're looking for here, Coach. You know, it's I guess I get the feeling that you're constantly building your team as you move towards that conference championship.
Yeah, I mean, you're green and growing, or you are ripe and rotting. It's that simple. Here's the thing I do. Everybody out there, if you're into tennis, this is a pretty cool thing to do. A guy named Mike Springlemeyer many years ago told me this, and what I'd start doing in the early 90s at Clemson. So you get a piece of graph paper, and to answer your question, this sits in. I'd get a piece of graph paper, and you can imagine all the many squares. I put it on the guys inside of the locker door, and I'd say, men, here's where you start. Here's your XY axis. If you have a good day, you go up. If you have a bad day in your mind, you go down. If it's sort of average, you stay neutral. You just go across. So after a month, the guys got this little electrocardiogram up and down thing, and I say, now connect all your lowest dots. That's the work you're doing. And it really allows kids to progress through the entire season and to put look, the barometer most people use is who did we win, who did we lose to. And if you have too many losses early, they take a dive and let's say, let's get the season over with and get into the summer. They give up. If you're having a good season, well, maybe it's really not a good season. You're not improving. You need to have an individual barometer that each youngster has, Jason, that they know that they know that they know that they carried out some good work today.
Well, Coach, you do an awful lot of work in a week, and I'm sure that the kids respond well to it. Are there special preparations you make before a match day? A practice is different?
Yeah, you know, some practices you train through. Fall events, I never taper the guys. I just say that's part of the training. And matches, some matches you train through the events.
you know, usually Jason answer question up to 2 days ahead of time. I'll just work the guys like normal. The day before, I usually do doubles, brush up, keep it simple. You don't over-sharpen the Boy Scout knife before you go on the hunt. You know, you if you over-practice the day before match, you play. And I always know when I got a good team because they practice. Their ball striking is awful the day before the match because they're so nervous. If they play great the day before the match, it means that they're posers and pretenders and they don't think they're going to win. And it's a funny thing how that works, but the nerves start hitting them. I do enough to build a sweat up, get them to racing speed, then I back them off and I say, get out of here. And, you know, I usually try to manage that to where, and now listen, there's a little, you want to hear the inside scoop on the formula I use. I'll tell you that everybody can add, to four, but I always say there's two pressures, the pressure situation, the pressure you put on yourself equals four. So if we're playing a weak team and we know we're going to win, we're probably going to win, we overload the situation, and it's a one, I practice guys at three very hard the day before. I put pressure on them. Three plus one equal four. Now, if it's matches a three, if you're playing, you know, you're playing Florida or South Carolina or, you know, somebody that's really good, and that's a three, you don't do much the day before. You know, you just basically do enough to get a little of your sweat up. You say, oh, are you ready to go? Get out of here. Then you get them out of there, make them go to a movie or something. We used to, in the old days, I used to take kids to a movie, and I'd go do something that didn't have anything to do with tennis. The twos are easy, like the rivalries. Like, it doesn't take much to get somebody ready for the cross-time rival. So 1 plus 3 equal 4, 3 plus 1 equal 4, or 2 plus 2 equal 4. That's how you prepare the day before a big match. And please understand this. The tendency is to do the reverse before a big match, before you play UCLA. You guys are trying to over-practice. Let's get it right. And then they play terrible the next day. Or you're getting ready to play a team you're supposed to beat who's a one. You go, nah, no problem tomorrow. And you play sloppy, practice sloppy, Jason. Then you play terrible the next day. So you over-practice before the easier matches, under-practice before the big matches. The ones in the middle, hey, listen, you just got to get your butterflies to fly in formation because they're going to be there anyway.
Coach, is the conference tournament the biggest event in your schedule?
Yeah, of course. And to not say that would be completely wrong. The first goal of every team is to win your conference. Well, secondly, you got to take care of business with the teams you're supposed to take care of business with. Thirdly, you get some chances to play up and, you know, that you get the exciting matches. So that's the conference tournament's the most important thing.
Coach, I got to ask, and I was reading on some of my NCAA articles of this week, and we've had the kind of the separation of classes here. We've got an upper class, which seems to be the Power Five super conferences here. We've got a middle class and then a lower class on top of that. It doesn't seem like it's benefiting the whole sport as we go through this. It seems like those Power Five conferences are running athletics at this point. The NCAA convention's going on. There are several changes that are being made. They seem to have invaded the ITA. What do you think their plan is here? Is it for TV tennis, or is it some other? Are they after something else?
Well, you know, Jason, nobody knew how this thing, and they still don't know how this thing will play out. But as everybody knows now, they're talking about paying, you know, the athletes. Who can do that? Well, the Power Five conferences. They're the ones making the big money. It's frightening when you look at some of the bowl games. With 49 bowl games that they had, you could shoot a shotgun off and not hit anybody in the stands. Some of those places, there's nobody going to these bowl games. Gosh, I heard the numbers one time. I can't, but there's a big disparity between those top power conferences and the rest.
Well, Coach, you know, and before you go any further, I'm glad that you said that, because I came across some information here that the NCAA is going to allow these football playoff teams, which would have been Ohio State, Oregon, Alabama, et cetera, that they would be allowed to pay the parents to travel, Coach. They would offer them up to a $3,000 limit at the NCAA Final Four this year. Now, I'm curious, in tennis, have you and your parents, are you allowed to pay your parents to travel?
No, we're not. But listen, we're not even in that game. We're one of those teams that are not going to be in that game, and we can't be. It would bankrupt 90% of the schools. There's a heck of a lot more schools before those power conferences. But let me make a quick comment about paying the athletes before we go any further. You know, and I know that scholarships cost a lot of money. At some places, it's $40,000 to $60,000. If you take that $40,000 to $60,000 and you tell a youngster, let's say the sport of tennis, you got to play 24 weeks, 20 hours a week, 480 hours. Let's see, do I have a calculator here? Figured out 480 hours. For, let's just say it is $48,000 that your scholarship is worth. That's $100 an hour to play tennis.
Yeah.
$100 an hour. And the point is, people don't understand the difference between price and value anymore. So you have people, the youngsters that are getting a 46. After the package, think about this, the equipment, the coaching. If you had to pay for all that tennis coaching, if you had to pay for all the equipment, you had to pay for the trips, you had to pay for this, you had to pay for that. It's not $48,000 now. It's probably $75,000 a year worth of value that they're getting. But the problem is nobody looks at the education as value. So you know what would be cool? If all these athletic directors got together and they said, okay, we'll pay all of you $60,000 a year. And they write them a check, and they say, oh, by the way, you got to pay for your own school.
Yeah.
And wouldn't that be cool? Wouldn't that be cool if you reversed it like that? And then they go, wait a minute. That scholarship, so I'm on scholarship. Well, look, somebody's paying for that. It's not like nobody's paying for that. It's not just free money. It's not monopoly money. It's real money, guys. By the way, I get my guys to go to class. I used to say, do you know that for what your parents and your scholarship are paying, it costs you $75 per class. So when you go to class in the morning and you want to sleep through that 8 o'clock or that 9 o'clock class, if you don't go, somebody is taking the money out of your billfold and going and paying that professor anyway for that $75 lesson, this lecture. And don't you think if you're paying $75 for each class, don't you believe that, Jason, that you would sit in the front row and go, whoa, I better listen to everything. I've got to get my $75 worth here. People do not understand the difference between value and price. So that is what we should be talking about. I'd like for some of those, I don't know who's running the thing, making the decisions. All people hear is, oh, boy, NCAA is making so much money, and we make so much money, and the athletes deserve all this money. Well, you know what? You know, look, in the old days, we just wanted a chance to play. And if we got a pair of tennis shoes and a chance to play sports in school, what a cool thing, because it gives you great leadership training for life. But the minute they started trying to say, well, you get a scholarship plus this, and who gets all the money? And look, Jason, everybody's got opinions on whether if they use somebody's image and sell T-shirts or sports shirts and all that. I don't know what that – they could figure that one out. But the very fact is an education is priceless. It's priceless. The value is unbelievable. And where we have gone to in our whole country is that we do not understand value versus price. So – but – your original question about the five power conferences. These guys who are coaching tennis in five power conferences, look at the Big 12. Really, it's only the Big Six. Six of the teams have been dropped on the men's side. So these guys are always like, oh, we need no ad, we need no ad, we need to be on TV, we need to be on TV. Well, yeah, they're dropping all your sports. And they've already dropped six of them in the northern part of the thing. And these guys, oh, God, we got to stay relevant, we got to stay relevant. Well, the reason you got to stay relevant is they get pretty good salaries. And the thing is, because that they are in the game, they're going to be in the game of what's going on with major college athletics, at least in football and basketball, the ADs are going to turn around and say, well, where do we give them the money? Wow, okay, well, we can't afford all this. Oh, by the way, we're spending this much money on tennis. Okay, that's some. Okay, nobody's going to care about that one. Tennis is sort of like the number 12 guy on your team at a lot of places. You don't want to, you don't care, just stay out of trouble. It's just like a number 12 guy. You don't want him to get picked up for a DUI or have bad grades. You know, just please stay out of trouble, tennis. Please don't bring us so much visibility, tennis. And most of the times, that's exactly what's happening. But, see, Jason, my school and most of the conferences are not in that same ballgame. If they tried to pay all the football and basketball players, by the way, men and women, because Title IX, gender equity, and all that stuff will come in.
Right.
If they try to do that, we have no more sports. Well, you can't do that. So it's going to be a really interesting time, and I think that people, somebody's going to have to step up and take leadership and just say, look, there's value and there's price, but wouldn't that be cool if they said, okay, we're going to pay all athletes $80,000 a year. Wouldn't that be cool? And everybody goes,
yeah,
oh, it's about time, it's about time. Oh, by the way, guys, you got to pay for your own education. Wouldn't that be cool? And then they
that's a great way to put it, Coach.
You know, look, you want me to tell you what I used to do at camp? This is really cool. I never had a kid that I gave a scholarship to my camp, poor kid, rich kid, or anything that ever panned out, because they didn't understand the value of what it cost. So then what I used to do in the early days is, I'd have them work, carry water or something. You know, you can't do it for high school kids, but, you know, to be a 7th or 8th grader, you could used to be able to help out kids, and then the NCAA rules got so tough you couldn't do it. But I used to, you know, try to inspire kids, maybe some poor kid that hung around the tennis courts. And so what I'd do is I'd say, okay, you work for a half day carrying water, be the water boy, you get to play for half day. That worked okay. Jason, this is the best thing that ever happened. So I figured out that I'd have a kid work for a week, and I would give him a paycheck. And then he would finish on a Friday, and then Sunday he would check in to his week of camp to play, and I would make him pay that money back. And then he got to hold on to the money. But then he understood value. Now, you know, those are the kind of cool things that you could do, you know, gosh, back in the early years, but then, of course, people say, oh, you're paying kids, you're hiring kids, wait a minute, have you got insurance on, you got this, and over-regulation kept you from doing some pretty cool things working with kids. But I used to, I had a wonderful player, youngster out of a small town, South Carolina, years and years ago, called Robert Davis, and Robert was brilliant. He didn't have any money, so I used to get to go to my camp some, and I'd use him to teach the little bitty kids. I'd say, okay, go over there and earn your keep. I'll work with you some later if you work with these little kids. So he was brilliant with it. You know, by the time he's 16, you're giving him responsibilities. Now, of course, you can't, again, I keep saying that you can't do this stuff now. But the point was, this guy now has been 16 years coaching on the Pro Tour. He coached Sam Qureshi, and he coached two U.S. Open finalists, mixed doubles and finals of doubles of Sam Qureshi. He went to Thailand for about 14 years. He was responsible for so many players rising up over there. He now lives in Cambodia. He does a lot with Southeast Asia. In Cambodia, this is so cool what he did. This guy started a program in Cambodia called From Killing Fields to Tennis Courts. It was on CNN Asia. You guys could go, and anybody listening could go to YouTube and find what he's done. You know, the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia used to, you know, they murdered, genocide all of the, they called them intelligentsia. Anybody that wore glasses was considered somebody that was rich. So all the tennis players got killed. And it's an unbelievable story what's happened there. The few tennis players that escaped, luckily, they went to France and things, but they came back, and there's Robert Davis, you know, got befriended this guy. I forget the guy's name, Ritty something, but the guy, they've done unbelievable job with kids. Now, I look at it like, you know how proud I am of Robert Davis? He's a writer now for ATP Deuce Magazine in the ATP Tour thing. He's traveled all over the world for 20 years. He's known all over Southeast Asia. He's just like a missionary for tennis. That all started because he couldn't afford camp at my total tennis training camps, and I used to send him down to work with the little bitty kids, and he had a knack for it, and he fell in love with it, and onward and onward and onward. And do you know how proud I am of that? And you know, because of over-regulation, we don't get the opportunity to mentor like that, Jason. So anyhow, it's a mouthful.
Yeah, Coach, now the last thing I want to visit with you about today is, and you hit on value versus price here. When did, in your estimation, when do you think that the fans became more valued in their experience over the players in their experience?
It's the old battle of education versus entertainment. And value versus price, honoring the game versus not honoring the game. But it's always, Jason, been about education versus entertainment. And ideologies tell you as a teacher that it's about entertainment or education. Some people look at it, the fans are more important, entertainment is more important. Now, think of this one just in depth. Everybody would like to have education and entertainment. Maybe football or basketball, you get crowds and they learn a lot too. Nobody wants no entertainment, no education. And that's what we have in tennis right now. With this hybrid scoring system, the Bullwinkle system, and no ad and shortening it and everything, there's no educational value there. You've demeaned the game. You have not honored it. It's a bastardization of the greatest sport we have, the greatest learning tool. So we don't have education or entertainment. So you either have education, no entertainment, entertainment versus no education. So your ideology will lead you there. My ideology that cuts through to my heart is that we now are not an educational endeavor. And if it comes that way, what happens, the dumb down happens, is very much the analogy I often use is it's like we become an after-school activity like a band instead of a lifelong learning experience like a symphony orchestra. The band is an after-school activity. A symphony orchestra, people fall in love with the music and what they're doing and their instruments. It's an educational thing. And the problem is that the promotion that we do, whether it's bringing pizzas out or shortening the format or hoopla, we could have any type of hula hoops out there, it's not sustainable, Gibson. That's the tragedy. We might get some good crowds, but it's not going to be sustainable for those crowds, and it's not going to be sustainable for our youngsters. They will not love and respect tennis at a deeper level. Anybody watching Dennis Kudla the other night, could you imagine he lost 10-8 in the fifth set? Could you imagine if that would have been a no-ad scoring match?
Oh, my God.
Tennis is about drama. It's not about excitement. They say, oh, it's excitement. Oh, it's, yeah, big points. It's excitement. No. It's a dumb down. At the very, 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 very least, it's a complete lack of respect for the sport and shame on those guys. Jason, I wanted to say something that would solve things very quickly. Everybody knows this, too. You could very easily make a TV format or an abbreviated format and just go, hey, guys, go for that. If you got a TV match, rah, 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 and then do it. And then keep the tradition of the sport intact. Okay, that would be easy. But for some reason, that's why we believe there's a hidden agenda by the USTA, or the ITA is sort of buckling. But listen to this. Think how we've made the mistake. We've made the mistake in that tennis is an individual sport that we should be looking for team opportunities, and some team opportunities might be in any form. All right. And now we have tried to promote it as a team sport that looks for individual opportunities. We need to make that definition. Really, it's like track and field, swimming and diving, golf, that is an individual sport looking for team. We've misread that. The other thing is that scoring system and format are two completely different issues, Jason. Completely different. We should look, I would go for any hoochie-coochie show for format if we preserve the heralded and the heritage of our scoring system. Does everybody hear that? Shame on you if you bastardize our wonderful game. Do not make piano into electronic keyboard. Do not make chess into checkers. Do not make fly fishing into bait casting. Do not dumb down once more, because participation does not breed excellence. Excellence will breed participation. And then just the terrible, terrible way that these guys, the ITA, has pushed this through like a mandate. Shame on them. You know, an unjust law is no law at all, St. Augustine said. And it's an unjust law. It's tennis tyranny. I've got 10 bullet points of the terrible way that they have sabotaged this with a smoke screen. And all they've done, it's not like Chuck Creasy or Jack Sharp or J.P. Weber or Wayne Bryan or Jason Haynes or Paul Solis. Bobby McKinley, by the way, Bobby's at Texas A&M. He still likes traditional. I know that. Bobby, hats off to you out there. Great one. Are these people, a Clarence Mabry or Glenn Bassett, or on and on and on, they're going to go, oh, wow, I'm enlightened now. The ITA pushed this through, and oh, my golly, they're so smart, and we better do what you do. You live under tyranny where you go, okay, it's an incident between pay periods. It's really not a sport. It's sort of an activity. And you cut the heart out of people. You cut the heart out of tennis. And who's got the blood on their hands? These guys are all going to be running for the hills and say, it wasn't me. It wasn't me. And daggone it, Jason, the junior tennis will follow whatever the college tennis does. And when they do, people are going to – if you think people think participation's bad now, it's going to be like, hey, you want to be in the band? No, I don't think so. You know, I'd rather be in Boy Scouts. No, you want to, oh, I don't know. Maybe let's go play ball after school. It's not going to be a sport anymore. So, Jason.
Coach, my.
I hope you're on my show today. Everybody, go to American Tennis today on the UR Tennis Network. We had a good one.
Yeah.
We had a good one.
Coach, I got to ask you before I let you go, and this is the last thing I'm going to ask you today. We know, and I talked about it last week on my show, that David Benjamin has resigned from the ITA effective in July. And I'm just curious here, they're going to have an executive search committee formed. Have you been contacted by the executive search committee to head the ITA?
No. What do you think? Okay, now, when they don't let me on that committee, or if they don't let me on committees, I'm going to ask, okay, I'm not qualified, or I don't try hard enough. Okay, I'm just looking to put something together here. It's all because I have a differing voice. And anytime you weed out the differing voices, this is tyranny, and this is shame on you, but also your organization will fail. And I'm going to put it out there. I hope the heck they don't do another person from up in that area of the country, that really their paradigm for excellence is 18 matches a year, and let's play until the kids start huffing and puffing a little bit, and that's enough. They don't need to put one of these committee members on there that have been yes men, that have been just sort of hanging on the coattails and riding the boat. They need to go somewhere. I'm going to put names out there. Lynn Loring. How about Lynn Loring? Wow, 43 years at Indiana University, great man, very smart. He would be unbelievable, Golly, think about this. I'm just thinking about, the Tennis Channel. You know, Steve, man, how good would that be? You know, I mean...
Yeah.
A guy like John Peters.
Yes, sir.
Let's see. We could get a business guy in there that really knew what he was doing. and somebody that really honored the sport. We don't need the same old thing again. And listen, I'm not going to say anything good or bad about the previous non-leader or whatever, okay? I'm not going to say anything good or bad. I just, bottom line, it's time for this organization, the ITA, to lead. And to do it not in a coercive way, but to do it in a way, you know, out of where people will follow you by choice because you're into the educational value of things and not the expedience of trying to, look, USTA, great people, but the bureaucracy has no business in influencing college tennis. They become a lobbyist group. If the ITA accepts things or favors or anything, they become a lobbyist group, then, which is wrong. The ITA is, Jason, a coaches organization, as I said earlier in the show. And that's what they're supposed to be. We need leadership in a way that looks not just on those people that agree with you. You know,
Coach, when do you play again? When does the Citadel go on court again?
We got a match Friday. It looks to be rained out. We're going to have it against Coastal Carolina. Then we travel to Georgia Tech next weekend and also play that great team Georgia Gwinnett. Wow, something that's pretty interesting. You know, that they're going to be challenging. I'd like to see them take on some of the big boys and see what happens.
Yeah.
That'd be pretty
cool.
Yeah,
well, I love the interdivisional play, Coach. I wish there's more of it. The ITA could do a little bit more to support that, but that's another show.
Don't get me started on that. There's too many things we could do. Shame on us for not using all our resources to be as great as we should be.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Well, listen, I appreciate you coming on air today, Coach. You're always electrifying here on the show, and I wanted to give the people a little different view of you because, you know, we come on and talk politics all the time, but you are a college tennis coach, for crying out loud.
Yeah, and I love the sport, and I love it as a learning tool, and I love it for the value that it teaches, not just the fluff on the outside. Listen, Jason, thank you for all you do. You provided this forum for the UR Tennis Network, and so many coaches have been able to give their viewpoints, and God bless
That's
you
right.
for the work you do.
That's right, Coach. That's what we're trying to do here is give them those viewpoints, and we'll continue to do so. I appreciate your effort as well.
Thank you, my friend. Bye-bye.
Yeah, have a great day, Coach. Good luck at practice today.
All right, man. Bye-bye.
Bye. There you have it, ladies and gentlemen, Coach Chuck Creasy. And I say that with the utmost respect, Coach Chuck Creasy, because he is a tennis coach. He is out at the Citadel, and they are turning things around there from a program that you don't hear much about to a program that you're going to hear a lot about. And just so thankful that he comes on to our show during his day, because Wednesday's a heavy day for him. He does American tennis, then he came on our show, then he's got practice, and he's always giving back to us, and we thoroughly appreciate that. On the last thing that I have today, and I mentioned a lot during the course of the interview there, the football playoff system, the Power Five Super Conferences, they are trying to make college sports look different than what they are. And I had a thought here on a way that they might, the NCAA, the Power Five Conferences might be able to save face here. I mentioned last week that we know that the football playoff system, the bowl game of bowl games, which was the college football championship, drew in the most viewers. We know that they're talking about expanding it, which we knew they were going to do, to 8 teams. And yet all this money that's being derived from these events are going back into the pocketbooks of the Power Five. There's no doubt about it. That's why they're doing it. They're going to benefit the most. Now, they could save face here. Just an idea is to take that money from the advertising, the NCAA, take the money that comes from all these advertising during these games and give it back. Give it back to the small schools, the lower class, the middle class. You're going to learn very quickly that the Power Five, they operate college athletics, they operate college athletic business. What they say goes, and it's all because they think that they have some kind of superpower there. But for once, they could kind of have a Robin Hood type mentality here, and we've heard that scenario a lot here in Texas. It was a school program, UIL school program, that worked well for years. Rob from the rich and give to the poor. We all know that the top athletes are going to go to those schools because of the exposure they get and the likelihood that they'll get a chance at a shot at a professional sports career, whether it be the NFL, the NBA, MLB, so on and so forth. We know it's not ATP tennis. That's another subject. But if you took the $1 billion that they're going to make off of that, because you know it's close to that, if you give 8 games, advertising, product placement, all that business, you would get 8 games of advertising, and you should give that back to those schools that can't afford to pay their athletes to come to their school. All of these new at-cost scholarships, the in-attendance scholarships, what it costs. So we need to think about that and need to have the NCAA realize that they've got a great chance here to rob from the rich and give to the poor. Just a thought. I know it won't happen, but it's just a thought, so I wanted to let you know that was on my mind. I want to thank you for listening in today. It was a long show. It was a great show with Coach Creasy. We'll come back next week and put on another one. And I hope you'll get out there and hit some tennis balls if the weather's warm, if the weather's dry. And if not, get inside and listen to some more UR Tennis broadcasts. So thank you for today, and look forward to seeing you back here next week. Bye-bye.